the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Hello. Welcome to Unseated Airwaves. I'm Danny, and I'm joined with
Mila
and Cooper.
Cooper is a new member here, and this show is run by the Indigenous Collective of CITR 101.9 FM. CITR is located on the unceded, unsurrendered, ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people in the traditional shared territory of the the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish people, and currently is governed by the Musqueam First Nation. Sorry about that. Usually we've got that pretty solid, but haven't been live on air in a while. This is a first for Cooper being on air, so welcome. Today's episode was supposed to be about food sovereignty, but we had some errors behind the scenes and some delays. So that will probably, hopefully, be next week with a guest interview. And for today, we tried to come up with something with current and airwaves and what's current. So what's in the current running through our airwaves for January 22nd, 2024? This episode is more news focused. So before we get into it, I'm going to play a PSA and then you're going to hear My Blood Runs Through This Land by Black Belt Eagle Scout.
Yes, we love her. I mean, them. Is it?
No, I think Cat uses she, they.
Oh, okay.
So we're good.
So, either
We are big fans of Black Belt Eagle Scout here.
Big fans.
Very, very big fans. All right. See you on the other side.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca. to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Hello. Sorry, there's been an error. I use what we call Tidal, and Tidal tends to not like to work. But I'm going to work as hard as I can to make sure that you hear My Blood Runs Through This Land by Black Belt Eagle Scout. Because we love them here, and I believe this is a good time to shout out the fact that this radio show has been hosted by the Indigenous Collective volunteers at CITR 101.9 FM, since 2015, and we have an episode catalog that goes back till then, available on CITR.ca. Super easy, just go on CITR.ca, look up Unseated Airwaves, and you'll find all of our episodes. Soon, when you look on there, you'll find our blog, which will be ran by our member, Olivia, so keep looking for that in February. There'll be some announcements.
Thank you.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Unseated Airwaves.
Welcome. Hello.
Hello, hello. So today's episode is kind of newsy. It's focused on what's current in the Indigenous world, but this is mostly focused on the Indigenous world in what has been labeled as Canada and the United States. We will not allow you to forget, and we will not forget about Palestine and Palestinian liberation. Israel is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip, and you need to speak out and be a part of the action. Thank you. Now I'd like to read off. First, MMIW is not just about statistics. It is about our women and Two-Spirit people who are actively missing. If you only repost graphics that like show the statistics, that doesn't mean anything if you don't repost the missing posters. So currently missing out of the downtown east side is Jessica Baker. Jessica Baker is 5'4 to 5'5 with dark brown hair, 28 years old, and she's Indigenous. She has ties to the Musqueam First Nation. She was last seen slash spoken to on January 15th in West Vancouver. She was wearing a black jacket, possibly with plain black tights, or black tights with snowflakes or beige cargos. She has tattoos on her left hand saying 1111, a lion, 1995 across her knuckles, a left shoulder tattoo of roses, and quote, Jennifer. Right hand tattoo has cannabis leaves in the heart shape. She's from North Van, but goes to Granville Street occasionally and has family in Musqueam, near Dunbar area. This is the West Vancouver file number 24604 and North Van file number 241182. If you have any information, contact West Van Police or Constable Matt Plant, 604-785-3494. And then an update to that added by Notorious NDN on Instagram. Jessica also has seizures and has previously hit her head because of this. We are worried that she may be hurt somewhere in the cold weather. Please share and please keep an eye out. It takes one person to see her. Okay. And with that, we're going to mention the Aboriginal Alert, which is a new feature. And I know that there was a very similar thing that was just happened in the U.S. and the Cherokee Nation has put out their first alert with it as well. I don't know too much about that, but okay, I'm not sure about that. But next we'll talk about Killer of the Flower Moon. I did not watch it. I don't think any of us watched it, but one of our members, Olivia, has watched it, and this is your time to call in if you would like. We're going to talk about how it really centers the white man's experience, and it's supposed to be an Indigenous story, but really it is not. All right, one sec. Hello. Hello, Olivia. Hello.
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 Hi.
Oh my gosh, hi.
Welcome.
Yeah. It feels so weird to call in because I'm so often there, but hello.
Hello. You found another way to hop through the current onto the airwaves.
I indeed did.
All right. I think we should talk about this movie and this white-centered narrative and about Lily Gladstone, who we love.
Yeah. Shout out to Lily Gladstone. We love her. I'm going to be so honest before I talk about this.
Let's get real.
I only made it through maybe 30 minutes. Maybe 30 minutes of the movie.
Real.
It's so white person. The main character is Leonardo.
Yeah, that's valid.
Literally Leonardo DiCaprio.
Literally Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't understand. I think it is a good logistical telling of history in terms of A through D in, like, how things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it does illustrate some racism, but, like, there is a lot of stereotyping and a lot of, like, tone-deaf dialogue in the movie that, like, perpetuates violence. Like, there's one scene where they just talk about, like, Indigenous women in such a fetishizing way. Mm-hmm. It's so gross.
So gross. That seems to be like almost like a trend we've been happening. Yeah. That's been happening in like feminism right now. Like with the Barbie movie, it's still so focused on the man's like perspective and the man's story. And then just, I think a few days, like 4 days ago, Pitchfork, which is like very known music journalism place that has been trying to apparently include more femme and non-binary people. But just today, they merged in another like comical misogyny move with GQ magazine, who produces like the sexiest man of the year. like could it get any more male dominated than sexiest man of the year magazine?
I don't understand this trend. It's like we're almost getting new age feminism, but then it like there's a curveball of like, no, like this is all men. Like men are more valid for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like under capitalism and colonialism, like we can only get so far.
It's true.
And what was this about a scene about marrying a, quote, full blood for money?
Yeah, I was just about to ask about that.
Yeah. So basically the whole reason, the logistical reason is that these white men would marry, quote, unquote, full blood women. And because under the colonial law, like, that's who the money would go to. So that's why they would marry them. But, like, in the film, like, it's kind of creepy where they'll be, like, you know, on a date with, like, an indigenous woman. And then they'll whisper to each other, oh, yeah, she's full blood. Like, it's so awful and so gross.
God.
Yeah,
that's right.
And just that really seems like, I mean, I haven't seen it, but that sounds like a really kind of uncritical approach to blood quantum. And I imagine it didn't, but I'd like to think that there was maybe some critical approach to that, but I highly doubt it. It's still, like I said, under capitalism and colonialism, that pedigree is still, it's almost like with status, it's basically like they just want to track by blood, like how many of us are left, basically.
Also, this is an American-made film, right?
Yeah.
I was just going to ask if you guys know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to ask if you guys know the director. I just looked it up and he is some old white man that I have not heard of before.
I'm surprised.
Oh my gosh.
Always the white man.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was that I've noticed that how Americans talk about blood quantum is different from the way we talk about it in Canada. Of course, there's still issues with how we talk about it in Canada. But in America, it's a whole other level.
Yeah, so much more focused on, like, race than ethnicity. And in most cases, it's, like, gender and sex. In most cases, it aligns. But with this, like, descendants of residential schools and how colonialism inevitably affects us, ethnicity has shaped almost separately to racial identity, but it's still connected. So like in Canada, for example, there's a lot of, like, I'd say when I'm in ceremony or powwows, it's like a mix and all different shades. But in the US, especially with more self-governing reserves, like the Diné people of what's legally called the Navajo Nation, there is still so much of a blood quantum pedigree, kind of like race and ethnicity lines up a lot more, like how it did like pre-colonially, and that's like this fantasy in their imagination. And the U.S. is so even more weird about it than we are here.
Yeah, they always go into like the specifics of percentages and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like if you were to be blood quantum definitions, like 25% or something, but raised with your, oh my god, like full-blooded indigenous.
Yeah, there's just so much more to it than blood quantum.
That's so weird.
If you were raised like completely culturally with like your indigenous grandparent, the government doesn't care about that. Like they literally just want to track how much blood is left, like how much of this racial identity is left, and it's
That's really sus of them.
It's really weird. And we'll get in more into that of, like, questioning the motives with the Nunavut announcement and stuff. And we're going to talk later about the comment section on, like, an announcement that was, like, about the, we'll talk the details of handing over governorship and all of that to Inuit people in Nunavut, and Justin Trudeau signing on to that. And the comments echo that same narrative of suspicion of, like, what are they doing this for? Like, there's got to be something else. And that's how I feel about the status system. Yeah, then that's in, seems to be in Killers of the Flower Moon quite a lot. And it's very interesting that it's directed by such a white man.
Yeah, it's so performative, I'd say. Like, I get it. I get why he made it, but it was not the right execution.
I just would like to see more mainstream movies like this made by Indigenous people.
Yeah.
Literally, like, we see with Reservation Dogs what that can look like.
Yes, I love Res Dogs. It's a great show. Have you guys seen the third season of it?
Ooh. Not yet.
Okay. I don't think we have.
Is there a third season? Know. Am I tripping?
I think if there is, it would be out by now.
Well, yeah, shout out to Sterling, the filmmaker who is the brain behind Reservation Dogs. And I feel like, just please give us a chance. Like, there's so many amazing Indigenous filmmakers. But they still, like, it's like they want their fun little Western fantasy movies without the guilt.
Yeah, no, it's like, not to say propaganda, but like.
Yeah, it is. They want their fun little fantasy without, they want, like, it's like the liberal white guilt thing.
Yeah.
And I think if they feel like it's dealt with somewhat, they can be like, oh, it's Lily Gladstone, and it's so Indigenous focused, but they still get to enjoy their, like, wild Western.
It's still for a white audience.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, like, protecting their narrative. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very that. Do you have any comments, any more comments, Olivia?
I guess, like, the main thing I noticed in the film specifically is that, like, a lot of, like, the white men's actions are kind of, like, they're kind of, like, undisputed, like, or seen as fair in a way. Like, there's, like, this huge stereotype that, like, oh, the white people are quote-unquote struggling, so they're allowed to do this violence, which is awful.
Exactly. We try and keep it. All right. Thank you so much, Olivia. We'll be talking about Nunavut and this announcement. So I'm going to play this APTN clip, which we love APTN. It is an Indigenous news network in Mila.
Oh, my mom loves APTN.
Always on the TV. My kid is not going to watch Cocomelon. You're going to sit down and watch APTN.
I love the, like, dramas that they have on there. Have you ever seen them?
I've seen, like, the ads, I think. Yeah. I've never actually watched them.
Sorry, Denny, can I make a quick recommendation before we move on? Have you guys heard of the All My Relations podcast?
I have.
Okay, this is a favorite, and they have an episode called Res Doggin with Ryan Redcorn and Sterling Harjo.
Oh!
And then I think they also have another episode that has one of the main characters from Res Dogs on it. I've listened to, I can't remember the actor's name, but they're both highly recommend.
Yeah, I know that Cleo, the very awesome individual, shout out, who had my position before me as the Indigenous collective lead, did a bunch of episodes on Reservation Dogs, and I'm unsure if there were interviews involved, but still a great excuse to check out our repertoire of episodes and check out the All My Relations podcast. Really epic and really awesome.
Yeah.
But you're going to first hear from APTN, and then you might hear an ad or two. We'll see where that takes us. Toodles.
Toodles. Nunavut signed a long-awaited deal with the federal government today that promises to change the lives of Nunavummiut. The Nunavut Lands and Resources Devolution Agreement will transfer ownership of the land, resources, and waters around the territory from Canada to the people who live there. A number of dignitaries were on hand for the signing, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He says the deal is part of the evolution of the territory.
Leaders, negotiators, officials of many stripes have all worked hard for years with the same goal, for Nunavummiut to have increased control for decisions on their land, waters, and resources. And our government will provide funding to be there with you throughout the three-year implementation period to come and beyond. Formal name for this process is devolution, but in many ways it's more of an evolution in our partnership as the federal government and the territory, and also an evolution in the progress towards self-determination for Inuit living in Nunavut.
Nunavut Premier PJ Agiogo says Nunavut's most precious resource is their people, especially their youth, and that's why this deal is important.
Today's signing is for all the young Nunavummiut across our territory dreaming of a better future, imagining what others thought was impossible, and working hard to achieve what hasn't yet been tried. Our people have made many, many sacrifices in the name of Canadian sovereignty. In the past, too many decisions about us were made without us. With the signing of this very historic agreement, we could now bring decision-making home right here. Upinam.
Well, as we mentioned, the signing today is a result of 10 years of negotiations. Our Trevor Wright explains some of the background.
Today, the Nunavut Government, Government of Canada, and Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated signed a final devolution agreement for Nunavut. Devolution devolves or delegates authorities normally held by the federal government down to the territorial government. While it doesn't quite make Nunavut a province, it gives the territory greater autonomy to conduct its own affairs like a province. Changes include a 50% share in resource revenues for the territory, as well as a new framework with NTI on human resources development to increase Inuit participation in government. A yet undetermined number of federal employees will be given the option to work with the Nunavut government in the same or similar devolved positions. This will include much of the federal staff housing that come with these positions, which will be given to the Nunavut government. Jobs that will remain with the federal government include entities such as the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Coast Guard, as well as Crown corporations such as Canada Post and CBC. Compared to the NWT government, who only had 9 months for devolution in 2014, the Nunavut government will have a three-year implementation or transition period starting April 1, 2024. The federal government will also be transferring over $82 million in one-time funding for transitional activities over the three-year period. Trevor Wright, APTN National News, Hikalawit.
Hey Vancouver! For fans of Ocean Alley, Flip Turn, and Still Woozy, alt rockers Juice are bringing their signature blend of rock, pop, R&B, and hip hop to the Biltmore Cabaret on February 3rd, with support from Hembry. Tickets are on sale now. Get yours at admitone.com.
MRG Live is pleased to present the legendary DJ Shadow live at the Vogue Theater on January 23rd. Don't miss your chance to catch this pioneering producer performing music from his latest release, Action Adventure, alongside his rich 3-decade-long catalog, which includes collaborations with artists such as Run the Jewels, Nas, and De La Soul, among others. For tickets, head to admitone.com and search for DJ Shadow.
Happy fun time music Fridays at 12 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. 1 hour of happy fun time music Fridays at 12 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And unfortunately, we're all human. Except me, of course.
Hello. Welcome back to Unseated Airwaves.
Hello.
Hello.
That ad you just heard was for my dear friend Nikki's show. It's very wondrous and weird, and you should definitely check it out.
Let's go, Nikki.
Let's go, Nikki, for one whole hour of happy, happy, fun time music. So now we'll be talking about what you just heard. So we will be reading over the five phases of this devolution process. So how this will go, kind of popcorn reading. I will read up until, you know, where we get to, and then pass it off. So I'll start with the first phase, which is protocol. So a framework, and all of this is sourced from APTN. A framework agreement or negotiation protocol is outlined and used as a guide for negotiations. This was completed in Nunavut in 2008 when the Nunavut Lands and Resources Devolution Negotiation Protocol was signed. 2. Agreement in principle. The agreement in principle signed by Canada, Nunavut, and NTI in August of 2019 outlined the main agreed upon conditions, funding, and framework regarding the transfer of land and resource management responsibilities to the GN.
Number 3, devolution agreement. Building on the core elements set out in the agreement in principle, the final devolution agreement sets out the arrangements of the transfer and legally binds the parties to the process. The chief negotiators of the Government of Canada, Nunavut, and NTI will initial the final terms of the devolution agreement once the consultations with Indigenous organizations are complete. And number 4, implementation and legislation. Once the final devolution agreement is signed, it will be implemented over several years. Some implementation, such as drafting legislation and negotiating implementation plans, will take place between the execution of the devolution agreement and the date that responsibility is transferred. Some aspects of the implementation, such as human resources management and contaminated site assessment, will continue well beyond the date of transfer.
Number 5, transfer of responsibilities. As of a specific transfer date, a series of legislative changes and transition mechanisms will go into effect. Parliament must pass legislative changes, including amendments and repeals of certain statutes. Sorry.
All good.
What was that?
Statutes and regulations.
Okay. Oh, hold on, I lost my place.
All good.
Oh, well, the Nunavut Legislative Assembly must introduce and consider mirrored versions of what will be repealed. Federal statutes. Why can't I say that word? And regulations, various coordination and cooperation agreements will remain in effect well beyond the date of transfer. The transfer will take place on April 1st, 25 years after Nunavut became a territory.
The devolution agreement has 13 chapters. So the first one is definitions and interpretation. This contains a list of defined terms and provisions to guide the interpretation of the devolution agreement. The second is general provisions, sets out the legal status of the devolution agreement relative to other laws and other standard contractual terms. And then third is the transfer of responsibilities. This sets out the powers and responsibilities that Canada will be transferring to Nunavut. Number four is the administration of petroleum resources. This sets out a framework for the transfer of management of onshore, specifically onshore, petroleum resources, oil and gas, and for cooperation concerning offshore petroleum resources. Cooperation. Interesting. There's some interesting things that may be amiss there.
For number five, post-devolution coordination between Nunavut and NTI gives effect to a separate agreement attached as an appendix to the devolution agreement, in which the parties agree to coordinate and cooperate concerning managing lands and rights on public lands and waters and Inuit-owned land. Number six, impacted sites, provides a framework for the management of the transfer of contaminated federal sites from Canada to Nunavut. And number seven, human resource development, employment, and Article 23 provides human resource development strategies for maximizing Inuit employment among new jobs created by devolution, while ensuring Nunavut has the capacity to discharge the new responsibilities transferred from Canada.
Number eight, affected federal employees, sets out options and safeguards for the Government of Canada employees whose positions will be transferred to Nunavut as a result of devolution. It also sets out information sharing requirements to ensure the Government of Canada's role as an employer to those positions transitions smoothly to the Government of Nunavut. Number nine, properties, assets, records, and contracts. Sets out what property Canada will transfer to the Government of Nunavut, including land, buildings, records, contracts, and other assets, and provides a process for facilitating that transfer.
Number 10 is financial matters. This sets out the amounts and timing of funding that Canada will provide to the Nunavut and NTI to facilitate devolution. This includes one-time funding to support the process of transferring responsibilities and ongoing funding to support GN's ongoing management of these additional responsibilities. Number 11 is net fiscal benefit. This sets out the formula through which the Government of Canada shares resource revenues for minerals, oil, gas, and water with Nunavut. Number 12, implementation matters. This requires the Implementation Planning Committee to develop an implementation plan and requires the parties to jointly appoint an implementation representatives table to oversee the work of the committee.
Number 13, dispute resolution, sets out a framework for resolving disputes between the parties about the interpretation, application, or implementation of the devolution agreement.
All right. And now I want to talk about, so I wanted to lay all of that out so we have a greater understanding of the legal jargon and what's really going on with this transfer and what that actually directly means. If that was a little word heavy and a little hard to understand, I get it. You can always replay this episode online at CITR.ca or check out our sources here, which were APTN. And if you look up Nunavut land transfer, it's outlined in many articles. I wanted to read Indigenous.tv's Insta comments on this announcement. Indigenous.tv is a pop culture kind of Instagram account comparable to, I guess, 6buzz is a big one. What's another one? Daily Hive, I think, is one in Vancouver. I don't remember.
Urban Vancouver.
Indigenous.tv is like that, but for the general Indigenous community, and they're constantly posting all things pop culture. So here's, we'll read out the comments. There's three of us, and three comments. So I'll read out the first one. This was from at JoJo's Dressing Room, and it was, "Why does this seem too good to be true?" with the crying face and a heart emoji.
The second comment is from Sinkaleep, And they said, from what I've learned in the climate action plans, such as Terra Carta from our beloved King Charles.
Eye roll emoji.
The goal is to remove the idea of private land all over to, air quote, save the planet. Doesn't sound fishy at all. Another eye roll emoji. There's no way they would use Native people for this initiative. Another eye roll emoji. We can trust them to give free land back. And another
eye roll emoji.
Another eye roll emoji.
I do not know how to say this.
I guess
at.
Just spell it.
Okay, at FALINSGRNDDTR says, I am all for this, but I don't trust our PM.
Mm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that really shows how we're all feeling and how there's very much that skepticism. And I'm very interested in the specific outline of onshore is solely governed by the Inuit community. But offshore, there's plans for cooperation, and it seems to be more of a gray area, which is quite interesting to me. I do fall into that also of like, it seems far too good to be true. And the instances I've seen of land back, which we'll be talking about actually this exact case in OK Falls in BC, around a salmon fishing site for our food sovereignty episode. But they were able to get the land back by privately purchasing it because it's that First Nation there, the Soyuz Indian Band and the Penticton Indian Band. The Soyuz Indian Band in particular, it's the legal name, is the richest First Nation in Canada, and they were able to privately buy part of the land back. And that is like seems to be, and the comments echoed that idea of like, under capitalism, I feel like the only way for us to actually gain rights is through private purchase. So this is just kind of suspicious to just hand it over.
Mm.
We don't have too much time, but I really want to quickly talk about this, which I think happened in the past couple of days. So a school board in southern Pennsylvania has voted to reinstate the district's old mascot logo that portrays a, quote, Native American fighter, despite criticism. The Southern York County School District voted 7-2 on Thursday to bring back the logo, which had been retired in April 2021 by a previous board who also chose to keep the name of the Susquehannock High School teams as the Warriors. So why this matters? In a report from 2014, Susquehannock High School's enrollment was reported as 946 pupils, so not very many, and 70 teachers. This position that was to bring back their logo has over 3,800 signatures.
Hmm.
So that shows a lot about the war on woke and how it's kind of, it's all, and I'll read out the, or we'll read out the blurb on the change.org petition, but I think this really matters because it shows that is way more people than work or attend the school or parents who have kids there. Mm-hmm. That is just people who feel very strongly about this.
Definitely from being shared online, that caused it to gain a little traction among these anti-woke communities.
Yeah. Here's this is ridiculous. I'm going to go skip down a little bit and read the what's under the petition. The Susquehannock Warriors need your help saving our logo/mascot. It was brought to attention that a complaint against our school's logo has been made, and it is seen as cultural appropriation. It's just racist. It's not appropriate.
I wonder what race the person who wrote this is.
Yeah. No. Same though.
They don't even understand what that means. Susquehannock's high school mascot has been around since the 1950s. I wonder how long we've been around. But after Susquehannock school board talked with members of the Susquehannock tribe, they saw that as we are called the Warriors, it would be more fitting for our mascot to be a warrior rather than a chief. The Susquehannock tribe was very appreciative of our school taking the time to accurately portray them and were very supportive with the school being named after them. That is so dehumanizing, and we were literally just talking about capitalist nations and First Nations, and we are absolutely not a monolith.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from this tribe.
I'd like to...
You know many times that I see like comments on things like this where someone goes, Well, I'm native and I'm okay with it.
And I'm not offended. And then they run with it. They're like, this one native like, said.
That person does not speak for all of us.
Aren't there like 562 nations in what is currently called the United States of America?
Yeah. And for them to say, like, it shows how dehumanized they see us as a people to say, we talk to the tribe and the tribe says this.
Yeah.
It's so dehumanizing. Like, I can't think of a better word other than just dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. At Susky, we take pride in being a warrior. Here, we are taught that being a warrior means to never give up and always persevere no matter what. Please sign our petition and support us as we continue to honor the legacy of being a warrior.
And why can't people just be like the tigers or something?
Literally.
Yeah, like, you don't need to persevere in cultural appropriation.
It's so, we could do an entire episode unpacking that statement and all of the implications of that and the legacy of being a warrior. It's actually chill, guys, because we think it's really cool that we dehumanize you to be these, like, brutalist, barely even people. But we think that's really cool and we love the spirit.
Yeah.
What?
People need to think before they type stuff.
Yeah, and it really shows that, like, in 2021, they removed it. They revoked it. And then this whole war on woke thing has...
Oh, it's really picked up.
It's rampant. Yeah, clearly by this petition and by it being reinstated as their logo, like, shows that, like, even in this short amount of time, like, 2021, and it's interesting that happened in 2021 because my... Grandpa attended, or was forced to attend, Kamloops Residential School, and you probably know that name because that's where the 215 number came out of. Since then, there's been other schools with over 6,000 unmarked gravesites discovered, but a lot of, or not necessarily discovered, but come to the public attention. And in 2021 is when that was announced, and there was a big rise on TikTok and everywhere of people starting to humanize us and try to understand.
That's what it took.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, well, what I've noticed about this is they wouldn't listen to our word, but now that we have, like, physical evidence, they finally listen.
Yep.
Yeah. And they're like, how could have this happened and no one say anything? Well, we have been saying.
Literally,
they just haven't been listening.
Yeah, they only trust what Indigenous people have to say once it's accredited within their systems. Yeah.
And that was the first year. I remember the September after that, because it was around May, I think, when the announcement came out, was the first time I had seen so many people who were not Indigenous wearing orange shirts. So it really, you could physically see how many more people cared about our struggle and what we've been saying for years.
Mm-hmm.
And now look at where we're at. And we tend to think like, oh, things have been so much better. And we have this idea of 2021 TikTok with art people like Notorious Cree. And just there's so many TikTok creators and people think things are better now. But this really shows that this, quote, war on woke is everywhere. It is seeping into everything.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going backwards. They really just loved their mascot that much.
Yeah. True, though. What did they say? It's like... Two step forward, one step back.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. We're just moving backwards. And the mascotization is, we don't have enough time to really get into it, but we were going to talk about the Louis Vuitton collab. I'm not going to totally explain what that was, but it was a Louis Vuitton collab that was Americana themed. And it was with, it was with Pharrell. Yeah. Who has had many controversies of saying that he was part Indigenous in some way, and it's okay that he wore a headdress on magazine cover.
Like, no, it's not.
Wait, we were talking about GQ. Was that GQ? Hold on, let me just make sure. Let me just check. But this mascotization is obscene, and I believe it's Nike has put out a whole thing where a campaign where they will pay schools to change their mascot. They will pay for new uniforms. They'll pay to redo everything.
Like, it's that easy.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we've covered it before, and there have been schools that were like, no, we love it. We want to keep it.
Oh my god.
It's obscene.
Yeah, people get attached to stuff, and then they really don't care how it's impacting. Like,
it's probably because they've not been in that position ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
They really
have no idea how to relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess all of this really connects with the ethnicity thing. Like, we're an ethnicity. We're a people that is not necessarily defined by your racial makeup. Mm-hmm. Like, there are many people who have been raised culturally, but their racial makeup is mostly white, and that is what defines us as a people, is that we are not just a race, but we are a class. We are a political class. And Dee Farrow Untai criticized it by saying, so when they do it, it's high fashion, but when we do it, it ain't. And that really just ties into everything. They have this fantasy, this Americana, the theme of the collab, of what Thomas King in his book Inconvenient Indian called the Dead Indian, which we've talked about a lot. And it's this fantasy idea of the pre-colonial past of dark skin and a headdress. And that's what they fantasize about. And that's what they think is real. And that's that's what they want to exist now.
Also, the amount of media that Danny and I personally have seen that talks about Indigenous people in the past tense.
Yeah. People love to do that. It's messed up.
And it's like the just TikTok comments or Instagram Reels comments really show if you see anyone who, and I guess in my own experience, I've only been told that I'm not native on the internet. It's only people who don't interact with Indigenous people that still have this idea of the dead Indian. And you can really see that in Killers of the Flower Moon. You can see that in the Louis Vuitton collab with this Americana theme.
Well, often, like I notice in these comments, it's Americans, like people from the United States saying this. And that,
because that's what they've been taught.
Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about like the idea of like the perfect native person that they see as like the an actual Indian native person, but they don't interact with this community on a regular basis, so they really don't understand what this community is like now.
Yeah, 100%. And I think there's a huge component of erasure just in Canadian, having a Canadian identity or an American identity in general.
Yeah, there is just so much erasure. Like they, and that's why these people are so ignorant. And they see people who look like me on TikToks, just, and it's intended for the Indigenous community to see. And they'll see that and be like, "Excuse me, you are not." And then they idolize creators like Notorious Cree, for example, who is their fantasy at the Dead Indian. He's a great person, whatever. James Jones, I believe is his name, but he is he fits all of their standards, all the standards of the Dead Indian. He wears traditional dress. He has both Indigenous parents, and most of his racial identity is what would be called like Indigenous blood quantum. So he fits the Dead Indian trope, and people, when they see people like us,
I think it's a comfort thing sometimes. Like, anything other than that is out of their comfort zone and what they see as like the norm.
Fully.
Yeah, and it's, if it's not familiar to them, they're not willing to like sit and learn something new.
And with that, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I saw you dancing on the floor. I saw you laughing behind your bangs, dancing gangster style while he holds your hand. Like to dance too, why do the shimmy?